This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. We know there's been a revolution in communication in the last 30 years. In 1982, you probably couldn't have reached into your pocket and pulled out a slim, compact device and called a friend. But the revolution in communication is not just a human phenomenon. Things are now interacting with each other, like the tags on clothes that tell sensors in the store if someone tries to leave with the clothes, or new home heating systems that you can try to program with your cell phone. Welcome to a world where things sometimes talk to each other more than they talk to people. And joining us to talk about the benefits and some of the downsides, the scary sides of this new world, are Sanjay Sarma, professor of mechanical engineering at MIT, David Rose, founder of Ambient Devices and Vitality, and David Stevenson, principal of Stevenson Strategies and an author of the ebook Smart Stuff. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Glad to be here.
So, Sanjay Sarma, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to plunge right into a concrete example that I know you've talked about before. So you've got someone coming over to clean your house or feed your dog, but you've locked your door. So what do you do?
Well, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could just unlock my door from my cell phone? And in fact, what we did is we instrumented our house. I worked with a friend of mine by the name of Julian Gershwin, and we put in sensors and actuators. And effectively, I can control my home remotely, monitor the temperatures, turn the heating on if a guest arrives early, and so on. And it permits me to also turn the heating down when there's no one there.
So how does your house, besides the heating system, does it in any way differ from sort of the average house out there?
Yes, my house has dozens of sensors that sense temperature and sense motion and so on, and we can use that to be very aggressive with things like conserving energy and turning lights off and so on.
And I know you've done an infrared look at your house, so you can see if you've got a broken window, right? If there's just a hairline crack, but heat is flowing out of that window and you're just losing money.
That's absolutely right. You know, an open window, you don't see the heat flowing out, but you should really think of dollar bills flying out of that window, right? And if you can see them, you can shut them down and keep the dollars in your pocket, right? So you can do some fantastic stuff with sensing. The problem is that sensors were hard to connect up, and that's what's changed. And now we can do it.
Okay. So now, was it very expensive to wire your house in a way that you're able to control heat and take a look at heat loss and that kind of thing? Was this a very expensive proposition?
Yeah, the first time it is expensive today, but that's what's going to change. And David, I think, are going to talk about how the costs are plummeting because communication is becoming a commodity. And that's really the expensive part of it. Once the costs come down, adoption will rise, and then it's a virtuous cycle.
Let's talk for a minute just about this idea of the Internet of Things, things talking to each other. So when you take an infrared picture of your house, in a way the house is telling you, in a way that it hasn't been able to before, here's where all the problems in this house are. Is that becoming more symptomatic of the world we live in, that things are actually talking to other things?
Yeah, and it's happening all the time, and I'm sure that if you look at our audience today, if they just look in their pockets, there are things there that are talking to other things. They have a phone that is talking to their Bluetooth system. Their phone might talk to their car. Their Bluetooth system might talk to their car. So, in fact, it's already happened. We are just articulating it now, right?
What do phones know? That phone that everybody has in their pocket, what do phones know that we may not even realize they know?
Well, I mean, your phone knows, if you have an iPhone, for example, it knows your listening habits, knows whom you're phoning, it potentially knows where you've been, barring some, you know, privacy safeguards. It knows when you drove, right? It could know where you parked your car. The fact of the matter is that this information is very rich and, I will admit, potentially scary.
Yeah, David Rose, come get in here.
Well, I think the cell phone is this uber sensor that can really measure so many things. I mean, it's interesting because there's so many of them, and they are already connected to the cloud. All these phones are already connected. I'm working as an advisor to this MIT startup called Ginger.io, which is doing a health app that measures your behavior along three dimensions that are important: your physical health, your mental health, and your social health. So it looks at all of the data that's coming in through your phone and tries to give you a sense of sort of your own balance along these three dimensions. You know, are you being more of a hermit this week or more of a social butterfly? Are you being like more active or not getting enough exercise? And it's so I think the power really is to offer these sort of new mirrors for you to understand your own behavior and to, you know, it's a feedback loop of sorts that gets you to hopefully behave in ways that are in your own best interest.
Now, is it a little scary in the sense that your phone, and many people don't even realize this, knows, essentially can track you, knows where you are. It may even, you know, with accelerometers and things, it may know how fast you're going, like how fast you're actually going down the street. Is it scary that it knows all this stuff about you that people don't even know?
Yeah, maybe we should talk about the Progressive Insurance application because that's one where, you know, it's where not only is the party who's doing the tracking, you know, sort of trying to encourage more positive behavior, but they're also trying to manage their own insurance claims and manage their own, you know, risk. And if they know you're driving, you know, twice as fast as you should be driving in that particular place, or as you around the roundabouts in Boston and you're screaming around the corners and pulling, you know, 1.5 G's or whatever in your new car, maybe they should offer you a different rate based on that reckless driving.
So how does Progressive work now? Do they essentially make a deal with you where they know what you're doing? David Stevenson, I'll throw
this to you.
Yes, they
do. They have there's a little gizmo that very much similar to the Cloud Car project at MIT that plugs into the diagnostic port on your car and records what your actual behavior is. So the estimate for your policy is no longer based on these self-reporting approximations. You know, I drive 6,000 miles a year, whatever. It's actually based on your real performance. And they claim that it can't hurt you, that your premium won't go up as a result. But one has to wonder whether over time there are a number of other companies that are doing this, and it's much more common in Europe, for example, now than it is in the U.S., that whether that is going to become a punitive fashion.
Well, it has to become punitive because we're measuring things on a much more fine-grained atomic level. And you know, so relative to your bad driving, Kara, like I'm...
is great, so...
But I mean, I guess you can argue this from both sides. You can say, like, why should I pay for your bad driving and your risky behavior when, I'm a very good driver and should have much lower rates?
Well, okay. So right now is the deal essentially that you give Progressive access to your information so they know how fast you're going, they know how much you're driving, they know maybe when you're driving, are you normally driving at 2 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon? They know all this stuff. And the deal is, in exchange for that, maybe you'll give me a lower rate.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
And can you imagine a time, Sanjay Sarma, in which everybody has to do this? It's not a deal you're making. Everybody is being monitored. So if you say you're driving 6,000 miles a year and you're driving 10, watch out.
That's, I think, unfortunately, whether we like it or not, you know, this is the future. And so we have a project that David referred to called Cloud Car. So what we're doing here is we are storing this information in a cloud so that you own it and you can decide what you are going to give others access to. So it's like a Facebook page for your car, except you own the data, right? And you can shut it down, you can stop recording, and then instead of Progressive giving you something you plug into your car, in theory, you decide what to give Progressive. So I think we need to get ahead of this issue. This issue is coming. And then we get into issues like data privacy. You know, paper you can shred. I believe there will be a time when we'll need a kind of a giant data shredder in the sky, right? Where you throw data and it's gone. It's never accessible again. So there's some pretty fundamental issues that are coming down the pike for us, and we need to get ahead of them.
Do you worry? I mean, we're going to talk more about some of the really interesting things that the idea of things communicating with other things can do. But do you worry about the privacy issues that are inherent here?
I do. But, you know, the funny thing is that it's the privacy issues are happening anyway. For example, every time you drive on the highway, there's a toll pass recording that you went to Point X, or there's a camera when you drive into a parking lot that can do optical character recognition and see that you parked in this parking lot, right? So the fact is this is happening. So it isn't a matter of can we stop it. All we can do is get ahead of it and shape it. And that's why research and discussions like this are very fundamental, I think, in our for us in our future.
David, Cara, one of the things that's a problem right now is that we have not had the government intervening at all in terms of any kind of task forces working on privacy issues with the Internet of Things. It's been ignored by both campaigns up until now. That has other issues involved in terms of economic development as well. But all of those privacy issues are going just out there in the marketplace at this point with no kind of overview.
They're all sort of coming whether we like it or
right.
not. Information about our homes and our cars
right.
and our families and that kind of thing.
May I make a comment
sure.
about that? I think now having said all that, right, and we need to confront the issue, the benefits are extraordinary as well, right? I mean, let's not forget that. For example, if I can monitor an elderly relative, right, with their permission, I mean, the benefits are extraordinary. So I'm also at the same time, therefore, concerned about government, right, coming in and forming regulations that preclude the good stuff, right, and throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And so we need to do this carefully, and we need to think about all the issues and get ahead with high-level regulation that says, look, here are the principles. I'd be concerned about government saying, oh, Zigbee's bad or something like that, right, which is very specific and really misses the point.
So let's, you know, you talked about elderly relatives. Let's dive right into here to health, which I know some of you have worked on and thought about. And David Rose, I'm going to start with you. You've actually brought in what looks like a pill bottle, and the idea here is, with the Internet of Things, a thing communicating with another thing to improve health. Explain what you've got and what it does.
Sure. So about 4 years ago, I started this company called Vitality, and we focused on trying to use the Internet of Things to improve health. And we studied the problem, and we found that the biggest area that we could really change in a meaningful way was people taking their medications more regularly. So pharmaceutical companies lose $80 billion in pills that are prescribed but not taken. And health insurance companies lose $300 billion a year just in the U.S. in unnecessary hospitalizations due to people not taking their medication.
How would pharmaceutical companies lose money? It seems like actually it'd be helpful if you overbought and undertook your medication.
Yeah, but then you don't go refill.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Right. So so our approach was to change the pill bottle cap that you now find on all of the medications you might get from CVS or Walgreens. So we took the base, the amber bottle, and said, let's not change that. Let's just put a little bit of intelligence, a little wireless chip that talks to the cloud into the top of the pill bottle cap, and a little LED and a little sound chip so it can play cute little ringtones to remind you in a sort of hopefully subtle and not too obnoxious way. And rather than we did make these available on Amazon for a while, but we found that we worked with the Center for Connected Health at Mass General Hospital, and we did a clinically controlled study, and we found that with these internet-connected pill bottle caps that could not only pulse with light and play cute ringtones, but also send you and a loved one an email at the end of the week to show you which days you did or didn't take a medication. So a variety of incentives that were all catalyzed by this little wireless object got people to take their meds over 95% of the time, which is just incredible. Like, it's so good by industry standards that it was then picked up by Novartis, by a few other pharmaceutical companies, and now by health insurers because they save a lot of money when people take their medication. But it brings up a sort of interesting point about the agency of these objects. You know, is this something that you're buying for yourself, like a gym membership to make yourself better? Or if this is being paid for and subsidized by these other parties that are also seeing benefits, which is what's happening in this case. You know, no individual has to pay for this. It encourages positive behavior, which lowers healthcare costs, which reduces the incidence of hospitalizations. So these are being given away with prescriptions. But it brings up the important point that was made earlier, which is, who owns that data and what can, and for how long, and what can they do with that?
Right, right. Should you be culpable if you don't take a medication that your doctor has said you absolutely have to take?
Well,
this,
and what's the
to
doctor's role now that that data is available? What is the doctor's role in your non-adherence?
Right. We are talking about the Internet of Things, things talking to each other. Right now, we're talking about pill bottles, and I'm speaking with David Rose, the founder of Ambient Devices and Vitality, and Sanjay Sarma, professor of mechanical engineering at MIT, and David Stevenson, principal of Stevenson Strategies. I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. So one of my questions about this pill bottle is, does that mean that the way you described it is that if you didn't take your medications today, it can send a text to your daughter across the country and say, hey, you know, mom or dad, they didn't take their medication today.
That's right. It's just a sensor. So you can hook up any of these communication channels to that sensor. I mean, conceivably, we had people that said, could you tweet to all of my Twitter followers, sorry, when I don't take my medication? Like, of course, it's just internet plumbing after you get the sensor that knows that the medication has not been opened. What we chose to do was sort of design principle number one was to let people choose. So we said, do you want to be reminded? You don't have to be reminded. Do you want a text message to go to yourself? Do you want it to go to a loved one? Do you want your home phone to be called? Do you want the data to flow to your doctor? Do you not want it to flow to the doctor? So first of all, everything is sort of an opt-in, which I think is a good design principle for all of these things. I'm really intrigued with this category of connected object that encourages a behavior that's a public good, you know, encourages safer driving, encourages smarter behavior as it applies to health. The company that I found 10 years ago was Ambient Devices, and they have a device. I have one glowing in front of me here called the Ambient Orb, and that device glows different colors based on how much you're paying for energy right now. So it's being given away by large energy companies in order to encourage more energy conservation in the home, which is also just an obvious net positive for the energy companies because they don't have to build more power plants, they don't have rolling brownouts in California, and they can do peak shaving. So, you know, when there's a lot of load on the grid, they can signal to people that the price of energy is higher now. Therefore, you know, postpone your dishwashing, until later.
So this orb that you have here, which is about the size of sort of a kitchen sponge, it's glowing green right now. What does that say about the WGBH building?
right now the color is mapped to the price of energy where we are now.
Oh, okay.
So it's similar to, it's the same as the load on the grid. So the grid is good. So you don't have to watch out that you're going to be spending more than you otherwise might for energy.
Okay. So let's say this was August 15th, and there was a ton of pressure on the grid, and people were really pulling on it to run air conditioners because it was 98 degrees and all that kind of thing. What color might it glow?
It might be yellow. It might be orange. It might be red if a brownout is imminent.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sprinkle these things around, they have sort of a glanceability that you never would get from an app or from a website. You know, you can't get someone to go check the app 8 times a day and see what the price of energy is. But if you sprinkle these things, I almost think of it as liberated pixels. You know, the pixels were in your screen are now blown up, and they just become paint everywhere in your environment. And if you can spread the information that you care about most, which might be traffic congestion on a commute, when the next bus is coming, what's the pollen count if you have kids that are asthmatic. You know, if you can sort of put that data in places where you're gonna just bump into it, and it's sort of unavoidable, then it's super convenient, and it really changes people's behavior in a positive way.
And I should say, you've created orbs that can predict all these things. Pollen count. You can wake up in the morning, look at the orb next to your bed, and it's tracking pollen count. It's tracking the stock market, right? It's tracking all sorts of different things, however
Absolutely.
You program it.
Yeah, I think it's a new category I'm sort of surprised that big companies like LG and Samsung and Sony and other people that are all duking it out right now for handsets don't just pay attention to how much more opportunity there is. You know, there's at least a 10 or 100 times larger opportunity for these little internet-connected cloud droplets, if you will, you know, that take information that's on the web and in the cloud and sort of put it around your life that in a way isn't calming. You know, you sort of want to know all this information, but you don't care to open the app and go to swipe and blah, blah, blah. You know, you really sort of want it in your periphery.
I'm going to get to David Stevenson and his teddy bear in just a minute. We also, I should say, on our Twitter feed, if you want to see pictures of the smart teddy bear that we're about to talk about and the pill bottle, the smart pill bottle that will text you that we just talked about, you can go to our Twitter at Boss Public Radio. But Sanjay Sarma, first, David Rose talked about drug companies giving away these pill bottles for free, even though they do cost the drug company money, or large companies giving away energy orbs for free so you can get a sense of what the energy situation on the grid is like. Do you see that potentially happening where it's of such benefit to a company to have a sense of what's going for their employees, to have such a sense of what's going on to their customers that they give things away for free?
Absolutely. So, for example, take monitoring of fleets of vehicles, right? You've all seen cars being, or, you know, for example, a truck with the engine running when the driver's off doing something, right? It would be very easy for a company to signal to the driver that it's better to turn the engine off, or to say traffic congestion ahead, turn right before you get there. In fact, recently UPS redesigned their routes to reduce the number of left turns because they consume more power, more energy, and to encourage right turns because it's quicker.
That's fascinating.
We should all do the same.
Fewer left turns. Okay, good to know.
So I think that this will also happen in businesses. But I think one of the trends we're seeing right now is businesses have become somewhat stodgy, and it's the consumer who adopts faster. In fact, consumers often take their iPhones into their businesses and go, hey, you know, how can I get my iPhone to be useful in my daily work? And businesses are having a tough time keeping up. So there's a little bit of a reversal going on here, and I joke that it's gone from B to B to C, business to business to consumer, to it's gone instead to B to C to B, which is businesses now market directly to consumers, and consumers go back to their companies and try and get the company to play ball.
Right.
But I think businesses that wake up to the reality of what is possible have a huge opportunity in front of them. Are they quick enough? We'll see.
David Stevenson, staying in the realm of health where we were with David Rose, you've got a teddy bear in front of you.
This is Jerry the teddy bear.
Okay.
And David has a term of enchanted objects, which I think this definitely classifies.
He's very cute.
Exactly. Isn't he something? At any rate, this is aimed at 3 to 7-year-old kids who have type 1 diabetes. And in the past, when you think about it, all the information has flowed to the parents, but the poor kids are pincushions and haven't been empowered at all with information or any way to deal with it. So these two young entrepreneurs from Northwestern University who are now operating out of a startup hub in Providence came up with Jerry the Bear, which has a little monitor in its stomach, and the kids can check the glucose levels. They can feed him a snack and see how that affects it. They can do various scenarios. So, for example, you're playing a soccer game or something like that and has to come out and take a snack. And it's really empowering the kids and changing that whole relationship that they have. They're no longer the victims of this. They're taking care of Jerry. And it's really a remarkable thing. And this is just in its infancy. In fact, these two young entrepreneurs have a goal of doing this for a whole range of other chronic childhood illnesses.
So you're really learning as a kid to manage the flow of information.
Right.
Instead of your parents always looking at levels and understanding about where exercise fits in and food fits in, you start to understand that
exactly.
Yourself.
Right, so it's quite empowering.
And do you see other ways that this, we talked about the pill bottles, we talked about the teddy bear, do you see other ways that this is changing healthcare?
Well, they're now, David mentioned the app that he's working on. There are 14,000 different apps now for health and wellness for iPhones and Androids. And it spawned a whole movement, the quantified self, which is taking people who don't necessarily have any serious illness, but want to track various aspects of their wellness, and they are now self-reporting to the cloud. And it's really remarkable what that can do. And I think it's going to fundamentally transform the doctor-patient relationship. It's no longer going to be the episodic kind of thing where you have long periods of time and then you have a doctor's appointment and they don't see what it's actually like living with a given condition. They're going to actually be able to have a continuing dialogue with you on that.
David Rose.
Yeah, I think what's really powerful, though, about Jerry the Bear, as he sits here in front of us looking cute, is that he's not lost and buried in the app store like all of these other apps. I mean, the nice thing about an internet-connected thing or an enchanted object is it has a presence in your life. And it has a presence that reminds you of itself, that reminds you of the service, that triggers using that service. In terms of the sort of quantified self movement that you were talking about, we see success in the Fitbit, which is a little clip sized device that's essentially a pedometer that's internet connected. Nike Fuel Band, the Jawbone Up, these are bracelets that are connected. And the nice thing about those is you wear them, and so the downside is you have to care for their batteries, which is a downside. But at least when it's on your body. You tend to see it every day, just like you would wear your watch every day.
I was
going to mention Kickstarter, the crowdfunding website, has been a great friend to the Internet of Things, because we see literally dozens of products, including some of my students founded this company called Super Mechanical, and they have a little chip.
We have interviewed John Kessner on this show.
Right. Cool. So it's essentially a sensor that you can hook up and that you can program, that you can toss in your basement or in your pool or on a door, and it will sense when it's moved or what the temperature is, which I think is a little bit too do-it-yourself for broad adoption. But the Pebble Watch, for example, which is this watch that's programmable that has e-ink, was one of the biggest Kickstart successes. I think they raised $8 million on Kickstarter.
Now, what does e-ink mean?
It's the same technology that's used in the Kindle. It was invented at MIT, and it's a stated display, which means it just takes very little power, and it looks like paper, but it's a addressable display.
Now, I should say a couple things here. One is, you mentioned John Kessner. It's interesting. We've been talking about how the first adopters are actually individual people, not businesses. And John Kessner, I remember well, because part of the reason we'd had him on is because he had this sensor where you could be on the third floor of your apartment or house, and there might be a laundry room in the basement, and you would get a text when your washing machine stopped moving because it could detect the movement, or you would get a text when the basement went below 32 degrees and your pipes were in danger of freezing. And he had asked for $35,000, and he ended up getting over $500,000. And he sort of was, when he came in here, his jaw was on the ground. Sanjay Sarma, do you see healthcare and this idea of things being able to talk to each other as fundamentally, as David Stevenson says, changing how we view our bodies, what's going on inside them, and our relationship to our doctors?
Absolutely. I think healthcare is one place where this is going to play out very rapidly, especially in light of the challenges ahead in healthcare. A bunch of my students, David and I were talking about it, a bunch of MIT students founded a company called Rest Devices. And what they do is it's essentially a vest you wear at night. And for men with sleep apnea, and I happen to be one such man, it tells you whether you have sleep apnea. It's just a vest. It's like a T-shirt, right?
Now, what's it picking up on?
It's just picking up on the chest, as you breathe. And people with sleep apnea, they essentially stop breathing. That's what I do sometimes. And it saves thousands of dollars in terms of testing in a clinic where you have to sleep overnight. And now just imagine We've been talking about electronic medical records. Electronic medical records are records of the things that happen when you go to the doctor. I think of it as a real-time electronic medical record. But the key thing here is you've got to own it. It's your record. And you give access to your doctor when you choose fit. So your doctor that you trust could subscribe to it and monitor it. Maybe if you're elderly, your child can monitor it, right? But I think that's the vision that needs to be shaped. My concern is that this is to be done. The best way to do this is to design it in a way where you maximize mutual benefit. Now, I have this term I use. I call it contrary benefit, right? If your health is good, it's good for the insurance company. It's good for your doctor. It's good for you. But if your health is not good, should your insurance company see it? So these are some fundamental questions we will have to address. And that's why this sort of thinking is very urgent right now. Otherwise, we will live with what gets defined rather than defining what we want to live with.
It's interesting. We also talked not that long ago to the head of Under Armour. A lot of people know the clothing company Under Armour, their innovation lab. And he said he thinks the next wave of clothes is going to be clothes with built-in sensors. So you have a sense of how good somebody's heart rate is, or whether it's perspiration, you know, whatever it is, pedometer built in, all things that could then connect to your phone and keep track of what you're doing.
I think the key to success with all of these things is a little bit contrary to the do-it-yourself culture, which is, I think in some ways we've done the smart home do-it-yourself experiment over the last 20 years. You know, there's a smart home magazine, there's protocols like X10, and except for a hobbyist community, it hasn't really penetrated. And I really think that the success to many of these things comes in designers and engineers getting together and distilling the service down to be sort of ridiculously simple. I mean, the experiment that we did with GlowCaps is we had four versions of the product that all connected via different things.
This is the pill bottle.
Yeah,
now.
One connected wirelessly to a little base station, which was like a fax machine that you'd plug into your phone line. The next one to an Ethernet port. The next one to a USB key that you had to put in your computer. All of those failed because it was just hard to get people to install them. We finally made something that looks like a nightlight. We told people it's the nightlight. It will pulse if any of your pill, you know, if any of your medications need attention, need you to take them. And it looks like sort of a muffin top, but inside is a cellular modem that connects to AT&T. But you don't have to do anything. There are no buttons on it. You just plug it in like a nightlight and
right.
Has a cute little antenna
yeah,
on top.
Yeah, no, it looks just like a nightlight. Yeah.
That's right. And so the user experience really has to be super simple. And that's sort of what's different. The programmable world of Twine and the Pebble Watch is interesting because there will be a lot of a huge amount of experimentation that happens around that. But in order to get broad adoption, it really has to be so Zen simple that it's just the ordinary object with a little bit more. I really like the metaphor of enchantment because it's the object and the way that you use the object as it was, but the device is connected and it just has a little bit more functionality. I'm reminded Ambient did an umbrella that is an umbrella, and it's an awesome umbrella. You know, like it doesn't flip in the wind like it would today. But the base of it has a little radio inside, and it gets the AccuWeather forecast, and it just pulses with a cute little blue ring of LEDs when you need to bring it that day.
So it's sitting in your umbrella holder, or whatever, by your door, and you see it glowing, and you say, "Oh, I need an umbrella today."
Yep. It's like Frodo's sword. It like knew an orcs were nearby. You know, but that's how simple these things need to be in order to be broadly adopted.
David Stevenson, in our last few minutes, let's bring this out of healthcare to talk about another area that is really changing because of the idea of things communicating with each other, cities. How do you see cities around the world changing? And I wonder also who is on the cutting edge of this?
Oh, I just heard watched a webinar from São Paulo, Brazil this morning about the IBM Smarter Planet program, which is doing this on a global basis. And they are, in fact, get this, they have a statistic that by 2015, there will be 1 trillion objects on the Internet of Things. 1 trillion. And yet, of course, nobody knows about it at this point. So,
but sensors communicating
sensors communicating
with
to each other.
They,
in Rio, they have a tremendous problem with floods leading to landslides and loss of life, and so they've created a whole city control center now that is the state of the art in the entire world. To bring together all this kind of information. They have detailed weather forecasts for 48 hours in advance that beat anything that the Weather Service can put together. So, and there's just tremendous potential for that. So you're going to have smart cities where, and it's not even enough to be able to manage things well. They're actually going to do things proactively. I hate that word, but it's good in this case. They'll be able, through analysis of data, to predict the potential for problems and be able to take actions proactively to avoid them ever materializing. It's
so we're
incredible.
Talking about putting sensors in a bridge, say,
exactly.
And you can see then if the bridge is weakening, if it's under stress.
Right.
So before it actually collapses, you get the team in there to fix it.
And this is being done routinely in the construction of new bridges in China now, which China has a very real possibility of taking the global lead in the Internet of Things because they are devoting so many resources to it. They're spending in 11 different areas of the Internet of Things now. We, to be charitable, could be investing in two at this point. So it's something to really look at.
Sanjay Sarma, what do you see happening with smart cities and the next wave of sensors everywhere?
Look, cities right now around the world are struggling, right? Many of them are on the brink of bankruptcy. Providing services to citizens, keeping lights on, removing trash, etc. There is no option for cities but to use sensors to make what they do much, much more efficient and cost-effective.
Hmm. We've been talking about the Internet of Things, cell phones, sensors, health devices, all talking to each other. And I've been joined by Sanjay Sarma, professor of mechanical engineering at MIT, David Rose, founder of Ambient Devices and Vitality, and David Stevenson, principal of Stevenson Strategies and the author of the ebook Smart Stuff. Thanks so much to all of you for being here. Great discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And back in the studio is Emily Rooney. Hey, Emily, what do you have in store for us
next? All right, so look around the studio. What do we got? We got computers. We got teddy bears. One has a little computer in it, so that's a special teddy bear. But
yep.
Paper clips, pens, pencils, you name it.
Right.
Did you know that somebody actually goes around and figures out how much every single one of these costs and, you know, averages it out over the year?
It's a fascinating, although somewhat tedious
and
job.
And it's called the Consumer Price Index, and we're going to talk about that next.
I can't wait to hear about it. I'm Kara Miller.
And I'm Emily Rooney, and this is Boston Public Radio.